Hi, and welcome to part number four of our training series for policy debaters. I hope you're doing okay so far. We're on to step number four. Today we're going to talk about evidence and its role in policy debate. I'm Alfred C. Snyder. I'm the Edwin W. Lawrence Professor of Forensics at the University of Vermont, but you can call me Tuna. And I'm here today with Andy Ellis, who's a debate coach at the University of Vermont. Good to have you back, Andy. And we're going to talk about evidence. Policy debate is different than some other forms of debate, such as some variants of Lincoln-Douglas debate and parliamentary debating, where they try not to rely too much on evidence. Policy debate does use evidence. Students find outside bits of factual or scholarly information, and they use those, usually in the form of quotations, to support the arguments that they're making in the debate. Now, if other forms of debate don't have evidence, and policy debate does, Andy, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing because it forces you to do research that is very specific to the argument that you're making, and doesn't necessarily bind you to the research that you do, but it does allow your research to become much more in-depth for several reasons. The first being that the demand and the presence of evidence within the community causes people to research deeper and deeper on arguments that other people have researched on, whereas in a system without evidence, you may not do that deeper research and you may not read the other person's argument. And the other reason is because of the pressure the pressure that's put on evidence within policy debate, it forces you to find the best research because you have to be able to defend the research that you do find. So I do think that it is very helpful and that it's very necessary for the research process.
I don't think anybody has a hard time having an opinion. Everybody's got an opinion. But it's nice to develop an informed opinion. And I think when debating, there's no substitute for knowing what you're talking about. When you know what you're talking about, you debate the issues better and you discuss things more skillfully. And the research component of policy debate allows you to learn how to get information. Let's face it, we're almost in the 21st century. You're probably watching us already in the 21st century. And information is power. And your ability to find information, to use it, to marshal information, to be your servant, to help you get what you want, is a very important skill. And I think policy debate will teach you a couple of basic skills which are essential. How to find information, how to find the evidence that supports what you want. And second, how to sort out the meaningless evidence, the irrelevant evidence, the dreck from the important stuff. Anybody who's done internet research knows you get to a search engine, you type in a subject, and you get hundreds of websites. So it's easy to find information. It's hard to find good information. It's hard to find the right information. Relying on evidence and debate will help you be able to do that. The other thing is that I think it really trains you for success in school, for success in college, for success in graduate school and the professions. It's very scholarly. That's the way that the scholarly human community works. You get information from other people, you use footnotes, you use citations, you take other people's knowledge and synthesize it into something new. And that's kind of what debate does in the role of evidence. What kind of role does evidence play in the debate? Is it all? Do we just read our evidence and compare it? Or what's its? Everybody knows that debate has arguments, but how does evidence play into that, Andy?
Evidence makes up a lot of the support for the arguments that you're making, and you can often refer to evidence to be the cornerstone or the basis of an argument that you're making. And I think that there are several values that it serves within the round that really help it to do that. One of them is to establish facts, such as numbers of things that are within the status quo, problems within the status quo. Those are factual establishments that evidence, that only evidence can give you, because they're from people who have done intent surveys on it. We don't all have the time, though we may have the time to formulate our opinions, we don't have the time to do the studies that are required to get some of the factual evidence that we read. Mm-hmm. So we turn to other people to support those arguments.
And it's nice also to be able to offer more than yourself It's one thing to stand up and say, I think this is the way it is. It's quite another to say, I think this is the way it is. And by the way, a number of experts and eminent scholars agree with me, my point of view. So one of the other things that we can use evidence for is to talk about whether things are good or bad. I mean, we can all think of standard, like you may think living forever is good, but there's always a bad side of it too. You would get, you know, bored and old and you know, things would be better. But they help us to see both sides. So if you want to establish, especially that, for example, going to college is not necessarily a good idea, it's hard to just assert that. But if you have some evidence, you can show that some things are good or some things bad. And that's really what's happening in a debate. A lot of times in a debate, you'll say one thing causes something else, and that thing that it's caused is bad, or that thing that it's caused is good. So evidence can help you establish what is good or what's bad. Mm-hmm. But also to understand causality, what causes things. For example, higher dropout rates mean you don't get as good a job as if you finished high school. And so you need a connection. You can say having a job is important, and you can have evidence to establish that. But you need evidence to connect one thing to another. Staying in school helps to get you a better job. So causality is proven by evidence as well.
One other thing that I think evidence is very helpful for is for predicting the future. And several academic disciplines have established very intricate ways of applying models for the future to try to predict what would happen if a variable were changed. And those pieces of evidence are very good for us to get the scholarly point of view and to get the academic discipline point of view on what it is that we're doing. They have predicted the future, they've taken into account a certain set of factors, and those studies by those experts allow us to have some ability to say that the plan is or is not a good idea within the debate round.
Yeah, in the debate, we're basically talking about whether the plan is a good idea and we should adopt it. And everybody's sort of looking into the future to predict, well, if we adopted the plan, would things be better? If students wore uniforms, would there be less violence in school? And so this evidence can help us predict the future. There could be studies of where it's been done before. Mm-hmm. You can have people just saying, even though we've never done this, if we did it, something good would happen. So predictions are pretty important for both sides in the debate, and you need evidence to prove those predictions. The final thing is that as sometimes evidence helps us to understand the motivations of people. The debate is all about what people are doing. It's all about our society and how our policies affect people. And it's important to know the motives and what motivates people. For example, what motivates teachers to do a good job? And that would be a very important question to answer, because if the affirmative team messes with those motives that cause teachers to do a good job, they're going to hurt the educational process. Also, people may like the plan. People may not like the plan. And if they don't like the plan, they're going to get angry. And so you need to have evidence to understand motives. Does that mean that you always need a piece of evidence if you're ever establishing any of these things?
No, each of these things can be established without evidence, but evidence lends some more credence to your establishment of it because it reinforces the idea that you as the debater have, and it, by looking to someone who has done scholarly work on that. Now, they may not have used it or applied it in the same manner that you're trying to. For example, they could have been studying a much smaller subset of the claim you're trying to make, but nonetheless, using them is only able to complement you. You can always make the claims without it, but it only serves as a complement and a supplement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First, you have an argument,
right?
And then the evidence is used to support your argument. One of the big problems that new debaters have is that they think their evidence is their argument. So they'll just stand up and read a piece of evidence and assume that their argument is made. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be the tool of information. You want to make information your tool to prove what you want to prove and get what you want to get. And in that sense, you have arguments, you have ideas, and the evidence merely supports them. Now, usually in a debate, we think of evidence as what many debaters call a card.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'll hear debaters say this, do you have a card on this? Do you have a card on that? And what they mean is, in the old days, people used to put their evidence on index cards, little 3x5 cards or 4x6 cards, and carry them around. Well, they don't do that anymore. But that didn't stop them from calling it a card. So every time you hear the word card, what they really mean is a piece of evidence. And generally, that's a quotation from someone, some expert, some publication, and it has the source and citation of where it came from. But probably the most important part of any piece of evidence is something we call the tagline. What is this mysterious tagline, Andy?
The tagline is a short synopsis of your argument with the piece of evidence. For example, if you were trying to make the claim that the education system is failing now, you may want to say, the education system is failing now for the following reasons. And then your evidence would go on to describe that. So what the tagline basically does is it provides a synopsis of the evidence you're reading and provides a part of the argument you're making in general. So it is very important because it describes, because it gives clarity to the evidence and because it's an integral part of the argument that you're making. Mm-hmm. It's the descriptor for mm-hmm. what goes on.
Yep. The tagline is what you're trying to prove with a piece of evidence. And generally, you want to let everyone know. You're telling the judge, the school system in America is declining. And the judge is writing down, the school system in America, arrow down. And while he or she is doing that, you are then reading a piece of authoritative evidence. You read the source, you read the qualifications, and the year it was published, and then you read the quotation. In the last 10 years, American schools have gotten worse. Students can't read as well. They fight more, and they wear horribly ugly pastel clothing. But in any case, it says and lays out in detail what the argument is. So every piece of evidence needs to have its tagline. Andy, is it true that the tagline and the evidence always fit together well?
They should.
They should.
But they don't always. There are often times when the tag is drastically overclaiming what the evidence says. Where, for example, the tag will say something like, the American school system has fallen to catastrophic levels, and the evidence will say that
it hasn't gotten any better.
It hasn't gotten any better, right. And in these cases, the affirmative or the team that wrote the tag may or may not be necessarily guilty of anything, but you need to point out that their tag and their evidence don't agree, because the tag shouldn't mean anything in the course of the debate if the evidence isn't there to support it.
Right. Never trust that the tagline that your opponents use goes along really well with the evidence. A lot of times they're just like those spin doctors in politics. They'll try to make it sound as good as possible, and you want to be very careful about that. On the other hand, you as a debater don't want to overclaim your evidence, because when you overclaim your evidence, that hurts your credibility, the judge notices it, they probably don't want to believe you, the other team points it out, and it makes you look bad. Make sure that the tagline, the argument that you're trying to prove, goes along with the evidence that you're reading to try to prove it.
The other thing that you may want to watch out for and how the tag relates to the evidence is underclaiming of evidence. Whereas someone may just have a long piece of evidence with a very simple and short tag that you don't think the card is that important, but if you don't, until you look at the card or until the next speech where they're extending arguments out of the piece of the evidence that weren't in the tag, and they've trapped you, they've lulled you into a sense of somewhat, they've caught you off guard because you didn't listen to their evidence, you just listened to their tag. So you need to watch out for under-tagging as well.
Now, evidence needs to be properly cited. And every piece of evidence should have a citation. And the good way to think about the citation is that you want to know where it came from. And if you needed to find it again, could you? And I think it's a very good idea to make sure that you have a complete citation on your evidence. And many leagues and organizations of debate require that you have certain kind of citations, and generally the more complete it is, the better. And optimally, you should be able to look at the citation for a quotation and you'd be able to find it mm-hmm. if you needed to. Here's some of the basic things that you should have on the citation of every piece of evidence. You should have the author's name or somebody's name. You should have the qualifications of that person or group. Why should we believe them? Now, the whole reason we have evidence is because you need to have more than just yourself supporting the arguments, expert testimony. And if your evidence is from, like, Joe Blow, who has no expertise in this area, it's just now it's you and Joe instead of you by yourself, instead of being expert. So qualifications are the second thing. Third, you should have the date. You should have the date. You want to know what year it came from. Evidence from 1999 is probably more relevant for debate now than evidence from 1899, for example, or evidence from 1953. So you need to know the date of the evidence. When you present a piece of evidence in the debate, these are generally the three things that you should use: the name, the date, the qualifications, and the date. Now, there are other things you want to have on the evidence citation that you wouldn't necessarily read in the debate. You might want to have the title of the book, the title of the magazine, and the article. You want to have the page number, wherever you could possibly get it. If there's any other information, like volume 2 or something like that, you know, it's also a good idea, if you're the researcher, to put your initials on the citation of every piece of evidence, so you know that you can explain it if somebody has a question, that other people on your team will know that they're winning those debates because of the evidence you've got. And also, it means that you're willing to be responsible for this evidence. So those are the things you need in a citation. Let me just say one thing about quoting a person or an author. Sometimes you don't. You quote names of organizations, right? So there's a group. You know, the Concerned Teachers of America issues a report. That's okay. It's okay to quote a group of people as opposed to an individual person. But whatever you do, don't fall prey to the thing of quoting publications. Turn to Horror in Our Schools, 1999. Or turn to Senate Hearings, 2001. Right? That's not really a source. We want to know who said it. Andy, before we get on to the use of evidence in the debate, I think we should address the issue of evidence crimes. Basically, evidence falsification. This is a very serious issue. Evidence is very important in the debate. It helps you win the debate. And it's probably not a good idea, although you may be competitively tempted, to make up or falsify evidence. You see some problems with, and it's happened before, debaters have done it. What are the problems you see with debaters giving in to this desire to win by falsifying evidence?
Well, I think that when you start making up your own evidence, first of all, you violate the ethical rules of most organizations. And once you've done that, you subject yourself to pretty much an automatic loss if you're caught in any of those instances. And it's not just an automatic loss. There will tend to be somewhat of a community disregard for you or a community distrust of you after you've been caught using falsified evidence or been caught falsifying evidence. And I think that that acts for many people as a deterrent to stop them from doing that. But I also think that the other issue is once you start falsifying evidence just so that you can have a card to read on something, then that's really something that you might, that maybe is an argument that you can make without a card. If you feel confident enough that you can win that argument, but the only thing holding you back from that is that you don't have a card, then try to win that argument without falsifying the evidence is my thought about it.
Yep, and I also think that it creates a lot of problems for your school, for your teammates, and I think you really want to avoid that. Okay, let's talk about how evidence is used in the debate. And it's not just a situation where you say, okay, now I'm here in the debate, where's my evidence? You need to look and prepare your evidence before the debate.
Certainly. Before the round starts, before you go to the tournament, you need to read through certain files and find what your good evidence is. Find what it is that the evidence that you want to read. And you should try to select several cards that are better to read that you feel that you might read in nearly every round. With those cards, you'll want to read it, you'll want to know them, you'll want to change the tags a little bit so that you can help yourself better to make the argument you want. You want to underline the evidence. That's perfectly okay if you want to exclude some of the parts of the evidence, if you want to just underline parts of the evidence and exclude parts of it that maybe tell anecdotal stories or something that aren't necessarily something you need to enter into the debate round, but are between the parts of the argument that you need to read. So all of that stuff you need to do before the round and before you leave for the tournament and before the round to prepare your evidence to read within the round.
My experience is the one most important thing that you can do to win more debates is to study your evidence before the debate tournament. If you're familiar with your evidence and familiar with your arguments, then you can use them. And I really think, especially at novice and intermediate levels, that's the key to success, because you're organized and you have your evidence, you can use it. As we said, when you use a piece of evidence in the debate, you're using it to support your arguments. So the way you would use it in a speech is, you would propose an argument, the quality of American education is increasing. Yet then you would present some evidence to support that argument. You would quote from author qualifications year, and then read a passage of the evidence, maybe just the first two sentences, that's the part you underline, to support your argument. You don't need to read the whole citation in the debate. I think just generally, author qualifications year. Some people decide not to read the qualifications, but I think if you've got them, flaunt them. If you have good authors for your evidence, let people know. It's very important to follow and flow the evidence in the debate as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you because of the discussion we had about tags earlier and how we talked about people's tags may not necessarily correspond to their evidence, it's absolutely essential to A, you being into the debate, and B, you winning the debate, that you listen to the evidence that the other people read. Because if you don't listen to their evidence, you're likely to miss some distinction that their evidence makes, or you're likely to just debate their tags. And if they're debating their evidence that you haven't listened to and you haven't flowed, then it's likely to be very difficult for you to win the round, because their scholarly authors who already have more credit in the round are making arguments against you at that point. And despite however fair or not fair that may be, most judges will find that the scholarly authors win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now this is part number four. Part number three, as you remember, was about flowing and note-taking. And remember how important it is to mark which arguments have evidence to support them and which arguments don't. Because for the reason you just gave, you want to take those arguments a bit more seriously. Well, sometimes in the debate, you have a piece of evidence that says yes, and the other team has a piece of evidence that says no. And sometimes you get a clash of evidence. And there, you have to analyze the evidence. And that's extremely important, especially if you want to be a good debater. You have to understand, you know, explain to the judge, yeah, we have evidence, they have evidence, but my evidence is better. Andy, so what are some of the reasons you've seen debaters use effectively to show why their evidence is better?
Well, I think that debaters often point out things from the qualification, that there is no qualification to the evidence, that there's a potential bias to the evidence. Like, for example, the evidence comes from a traditionally right-wing think tank and they're propagating market ideas or something of that nature, then you're going to contend that that's those people's job to write for the market. Of course they're going to contend that way. Now, these arguments alone don't overwhelm a piece of evidence, but they do help to cast some doubt and some dispersions on the value of that evidence in the round. One other thing that I think that you often want to focus on is the strength of the wording of their card. Often authors will highly equivocate the claims that they make, but teams will not read those equivocations, or teams will try to read over those equivocations, not trying to do anything unethical, but just trying to make the other parts of the argument more important. And you need to point out the maybes and the one possible scenario and the worst case scenario, which we don't think will happen, type of things that appear within cards. Now again, these won't overwhelm the evidence, but they will help to cast some critical glance on it in some way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think another thing to keep in mind is that there's some evidence is explanatory and other evidence is conclusionary. A piece of evidence that says the affirmative plan will never work, and that's all that it says. We believe that vouchers for school choice will never work. Versus a piece of evidence that says, well, we believe that vouchers for school choice will work for the following three reasons. A piece of evidence that gives reasons why something is true is superior to a piece of evidence that doesn't. I think sometimes evidence is better if it's more recent, especially if it's an issue that's changing through time and it's more recent. I think that's very important. That doesn't mean that the more recent card is always the best. Yeah. I mean, some things like freedom of speech is important. You say, oh, I have a card from March. You know, some things are not time-bound, and other things are.
I think one other thing is that you need to make sure that the evidence that the other team is reading or that you're reading has the same referent as the argument. For example, if they're making an argument about U.S. education spending or they're making an argument about how U.S. education spending has decreased over the last few years, and you read a piece of evidence that talks about how education spending has increased over the last few years, but it doesn't necessarily refer to U.S. federal education spending, then that's the kind of piece of evidence that's the kind of flaw within an evidence that can, again, easily be pointed out to a judge that will highly mitigate or take away the risk they have of winning that piece of evidence.
Mm-hmm. I once knew someone who had a piece of evidence that said, this absurd proposal will never succeed. And then they would just use it against anybody's proposal. You know, the evidence has to be talking about what you are relating it to. And then also, we want to say, as we did before, make sure it fits with the tag, right? Make sure that the evidence supports the tag. So there are some simple criteria that you can use in comparing evidence. One, source qualification. Two, source bias. Three, how strong is the wording of the evidence? Four, does it explain or just give a conclusion? Five, is it more recent? Six, is it talking about the same thing as the referent in the affirmative case? And seventh, does it match the tag that's being claimed? So that doesn't mean that if you indict a piece of evidence and you have no counter piece of evidence that you win.
Right.
Sometimes the negative especially will say, well, your piece of evidence is perfect. It doesn't say this, and it doesn't say this, and it doesn't say this. But that doesn't mean it's totally objectionable.
Right. I think that negatives or teams that are making those evidence indictments need to be careful to remember that it doesn't make the evidence go away. It just usually will make it have less weight in the judge's mind, but it doesn't usually ever take it out. It's just a mitigated argument at that point, and I think that's important to remember.
Well, that's the world of evidence. The world of policy debate uses evidence quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We've talked about how the research and evidence is a very important thing for you to learn about. And we've talked about how to use evidence and how to analyze evidence. And I hope you got something out of it. That's the end of part number four. Thanks, Andy. Thanks to you for being part of it. Keep on debating. Don't get cold feet. You'll be a winner.